I realize today that I will never know the answer. Not because the scenario is impossible, but because I have been barred from visiting Ben Carver again. I immediately suspected the hand of Huckleberry. But the warden soon put me straight. It seemed only fitting. He was the man whose report had brought me to Ben Carver in the first place. This is how it happened. Instead of being herded into the waiting room for visitation, I was led down a long hallway by a plump guard who kept sucking his teeth. The sound echoed off the polished tiles on the floor. The hallways are long and wide in prison, likely so you can run but not hide. There are large fisheye mirrors at every corner. Video cameras follow your every move. If only downtown Athens had been so secure, perhaps you would have come home to us. The warden's office was all cheap paneling and institutional green furnishings. As Ben would have said, think Cool Hand Luke. Every surface was either metal or fake wood. The warden was fat with a buzz cut and rolls of flesh almost obscuring his collar. His white shirt was short-sleeved and outfitted with a red and black clip-on tie. He smoked a cigarette as he studied me across his desk. I sat in front of him, holding a worn copy of Dr. Seuss's You're Only Old Once, a gift from Ben sent via the warden, the last communication Carver the Cannibal would have with me. He had revoked my visitation rights. I wasn't allowed in the prison anymore.
Dr. Carroll, the warden said, his voice sounding like Foghorn Leghorn. Ben Carver is a psychopath. He's incapable of empathy or remorse. If you see something human in him, that's only because he's playing the part.
I flipped through the book. My hands were sweating. The pages stuck to my fingers. It's hot in prison, no matter what time of year it is. It reeks of sweat and sewage and desperation from the men who are stacked in cells like chattel.
The warden said, obviously Carver's gotten out of you whatever he wanted. He's finished with you. Don't take it personally. Count yourself lucky that you got away unscathed.
Unscathed. I let the word roll around in my head. I said it aloud as I was escorted back down the long hall. I repeated it in the car as I sat with the book still clutched in my hands. You're Only Old Once, a book for obsolete children, was an adult picture book. Several years ago, you and your sisters had given me a copy of this same book on my birthday because younger people always think it's funny when older people get even older. I don't recall ever telling Ben about the book, but it seemed like something I would have told him early on when I was trying to trap him into revealing a clue about you. The conversation would have gone like this. Ben, tell me, Sam, what have you been reading lately?
Me, I found a book that Julia and the girls gave me for my birthday, You're Only Old Once by Dr. Seuss.
Ben, you know, my favorite birthday gift was when I was 16 and my mother gave me my own set of keys to her car. What was your first car, Sam? I bet it was an old jalopy. You would have been pulling in the girls like crazy. That was what he was like. He always changed the subject with flattery. He was usually more artful. It's hard to describe how someone has manipulated you because you're generally not aware of it when it's happening. You don't exactly take notes, is what I'm saying. I am sure that during my visits, Ben gathered far more information about me than the other way around. I have to admit that he was working at a level I did not even know existed.
and he was a psychopath. I knew that. But he was an interesting psychopath, and he gave me something to do one day a week every week for 10 months, when my only other alternative was to cut open my wrists and watch the blood swirl down the bathtub drain. I should have mentioned the scalpel when I cataloged the items in my silverware drawer. It has been there for almost a year now.
Shiny metal with a surgically sharpened blade.
I have seen how easily it slices open flesh, and dreamed about how easily it would cut into mine. I think what happened was this. Ben knew he had helped me climb out of that depression, and that it was time to let me go. Not because he wanted to end our contact, but because, if I kept visiting, he would be too tempted to destroy what he had worked so hard to build back up. So, while the warden was right about my strange friend being a psychopath, he was wrong about Ben Carver's lack of empathy. I have proof of it right here in my hands. I don't know how he managed to get a copy of You're Only Old Once while living on death row, but I do know that Ben was very resourceful. He had many fans on the outside. The guards gave him the respect of an old-timer. Even in prison, Ben could get almost anything he wanted. And he never wanted anything unless there was a good reason. The reason this time was to send me a message. This is the inscription Ben wrote inside the book. First you must have the images, then come the words. Robert James Waller. Images. I had seen that word before. At least 6 times before on my annual reading sojourn to the sheriff's office. The word was connected to a deed, and the deed was connected to an act, and that act had been committed by a man, and that man, I now understood, was connected to you. You see, sweetheart, Ben Carver knew something about you after all. Chapter 10. Lydia stood in front of the arch in downtown Athens. She looked down at her phone. She reloaded the search page to refresh the links. There were no new details in the Anna Kilpatrick case. That didn't stop the news outlets from regurgitating the story. They were milking the press conference for every bit of emotion they could squeeze out. Eleanor's heartbreaking outburst had busted the coverage wide open. MSNBC, Fox, CBS, ABC, and NBC had all abandoned their Sunday morning political recaps. CNN had brought in a shrink to discuss Eleanor and Bob Kilpatrick's state of mind. The fact that the doctor had never met the dead girl's parents, or even worked on a case where a child was abducted and murdered, did not mar his qualifications to speak as an expert on national television. Lydia was more qualified to know their state of mind. Their 16-year-old daughter was dead. She had been tortured and branded and abandoned on the Beltline. A joke of a recreational path that was more like a criminal hunting ground. At the moment, the Kilpatricks were probably looking for the most expedient way to join their only child. They had likely suspected all along that Anna was dead. But there was thinking it might be true, and then there was having actual confirmation. They had seen her body. They had borne witness to her degradation. Was knowing exactly what had happened better than whatever horrors they had spun in their imaginations? Like the Carroll family, they were caught between two guns. Lydia wiped sweat from her brow. The temperature had dropped overnight, but she felt hot, probably from shock or stress or a combination of the two.
She climbed the stone steps up to the iron arch that had stood at the North Campus entrance since the Civil War. Her father had told them stories about toilet papering the arch after football games. Julia had almost been arrested here during a protest against the First Gulf War. On the last night of her life, she had walked past the arch with her friends on the way to the Manhattan. And after the Manhattan, they had never seen her again. Lydia wanted her daughter. She wanted to hold her in her arms and kiss her head the way Dee only let her do when she was sick or feeling sad. When Dee was a baby, she had loved being held. Lydia's back constantly ached from carrying her around the kitchen while she cooked, or resting her on her hip while she did laundry. When Rick came along, Dee would drape herself across them like a blanket, her feet in Rick's lap and her head in Lydia's. Rick and Lydia would look at each other and smile because they had such a perfect little girl between them. And Lydia would feel such relief because the only time she truly knew that Dee was safe was when she was close enough to count her daughter's breaths. She put her head in her hands. She closed her eyes. She gave in to the images of Eleanor Kilpatrick that were burned into every fold of her brain. The way the mother had screamed with such damaged intensity. Her haunted expression, the X she had drawn over the left side of her abdomen. Eleanor was obviously right-handed. She had to reach across her belly to draw the X. She hadn't chosen that exact spot by coincidence. Lydia looked across Broad Street. Claire was sitting outside the Starbucks where she'd left her. Her posture was ramrod straight as she stared into empty space. She had the dazed look of a catatonic. There was an unnerving stillness about her. She had always been so hard to read, but right now, she was impenetrable. Lydia stood up. The 30 yards between them wasn't going to help her magically divine Claire's thoughts. She walked back across Broad, lingering at the median, though there was no traffic. Georgia had beaten Auburn last night. The town was sleeping off the win. The sidewalks were sticky from spilled beer. Trash littered the streets. Claire didn't look up when Lydia sat down at the table, but she asked, "Does it look different?" "It looks like an outdoor shopping mall," she said, because the campus had turned from that of a quaint southern university into a sprawling corporate behemoth. "It's almost suburban." "The only thing that's really changed is the length of the khaki shorts." "Didn't the taco stand used to be here?" "We parked right in front of it." Claire indicated the direction with a tilt of her head. Lydia craned her neck. She saw more tables and chairs crisscrossing the sidewalk. No one was sitting outside because it was too cold. There was a woman standing with a broom and dustpan, but instead of sweeping up the debris left over from the night before, she was checking her phone. Claire said, "He never asked me for anything weird." Lydia turned back to her sister. "I remember when I first saw the movie on his computer. Just the beginning of it, with the girl chained up. I had this strange feeling, almost like a betrayal, because I wanted to know why he didn't bring it to me." She watched a jogger slowly cross the street. "I thought, if that's what he's into, chaining people up and leather and blindfolds and that kind of thing, even though I'm not particularly into it, why didn't he ask me to give it a try?" She looked at Lydia like she expected an answer. Lydia could only shrug. "I probably would have said yes." Claire shook her head, as if to contradict herself. "I mean, if that's what he really wanted, then I would have tried it, right? Because that's what you do, and Paul knew that. He knew that I would have tried." Lydia shrugged again, but she had no idea. He never asked me to dress up like a maid or pretend to be a schoolgirl or whatever else it is you hear about. He never even asked for anal, and every man asks for anal eventually. Lydia glanced around, hoping no one could hear. She was younger than me, Claire continued. The first woman, when I saw her, I had the split-second thought that she was younger than me. And that hurt because I'm not young anymore. That's the one thing I couldn't give him. Lydia sat back in her chair. There was nothing she could do but let Claire talk. I wasn't in love with him when I married him. I mean, I loved him, but it wasn't. She waved the emotions away with her hand. We were married for less than a year, and Christmas was coming up. Paul was working on his master's, and I was answering phones for a law office, and I just thought, I'm out of here. Being married felt so pointless, so tedious. Mom and Dad were so full of life before Julia. They were such passionate, interesting people. Do you remember that? How they were before? Lydia smiled because Claire had somehow unlocked the memories with that one question. Even 22 years into their marriage, Sam and Helen Carroll had acted like teenagers who couldn't keep their hands off each other. Claire said, "They went dancing and to parties and out to dinner, and they had their own interests, and they loved talking to each other all the time. Remember how we weren't allowed to interrupt them? And we didn't want to interrupt them because they were so fascinating." Claire smiled, too. They read everything. They saw everything. People vied to spend time with them. They'd have a party and strangers would show up at the door because they'd heard the Carols were so much fun. Lydia felt it all come rushing back. Helen spraying cheese on celery stalks, and Sam singeing his eyebrows off the grill. Games of charades, heated political debates, lively discussions about books and art and movies. Claire continued, "They were always kissing each other, like real kissing. And we'd say it was gross. But wasn't it nice, Pepper? Didn't you see them and think, that's what love was all about?" Lydia nodded. She felt intoxicated by the long-forgotten memories. That first year with Paul, that's what we didn't have. At least, I didn't think we had it. Claire swallowed so hard that her throat moved. "So, I rode my bike home from work that night thinking that I was just going to be honest and tell him it was over. Rip off the Band-Aid. Don't wait for all the Christmas parties and New Year's to come and go. Just say it." She paused. Tears rolled down her face. "But I got home, and Paul was in bed. I thought he was taking a nap, but he was covered in sweat. I could hear him wheezing. His eyelids fluttered every time he blinked. I made him get up and I took him to the hospital. He'd had a cold for weeks, but it turned into walking pneumonia. He could have died. He almost did." She wiped away her tears. "But here's the thing. I was terrified. I couldn't think about my life without him. Hours before, I was ready to leave him, but then I realized that I couldn't." She shook her head vehemently as if someone had asked her to. "He was in the hospital for almost 3 weeks, and I never left his side. I read to him. I slept in the bed with him. I bathed him. I had always known that Paul needed me, but I never realized until I almost lost him
that I really, really needed him.
Claire stopped to take a shallow breath.
That's when you fall in love with somebody. The lust and fucking like rabbits and letting your life fall to shit so you can be around him, that's passion. It's borderline obsession, and it always burns itself out. You know that, Liddy. That high never, ever lasts. But being in that hospital, taking care of him, I started to realize that what I had with Paul, what I thought I had, that was more than love. That was being in love. It was so tangible, I could almost touch it with my hands. I could bite it with my teeth.
Lydia would have never articulated it that same way, but she knew from Rick what her sister was talking about. There was so much of herself that was wrapped up in him. Lover, companion, best friend, foil. All of this time she'd been focused on what it would feel like to lose Dee, but losing Rick would be devastating in so many different ways. Claire said,
Paul knew how it felt for me to lose Julia. I told him everything. Everything. I didn't hold back one detail. I can't recall a time in my life when I've ever been that honest with a man. I laid it all out. What it was like when Mom turned into a ghost and Dad turned into Don Quixote. How much I needed you to help me get through the day. She made sure that Lydia was looking at her. You saved me, Pepper. You were the only thing I had to hold on to when the bottom dropped out. Lydia felt a lump in her throat. They had saved each other. That's probably why Paul had to drive us apart, don't you think? He knew how important you were to me. More important than Mom, even, because I trusted you to be there no matter what.
Lydia shook her head. There was no way to tell what had been in Paul's mind. He knew from me what Anna Kilpatrick's family was going through, and he watched those horrible movies despite that. Maybe because of it, because I think he got off on knowing that Anna wasn't the only one in pain. There were all these other layers of pain rippling through the family, through the community, and even to us. You, me, Mom, Grandma, Jenny. He was constantly asking me about Anna Kilpatrick or referring to the case and gauging my reaction. He even brought it up the night he died. She gave a dry laugh. I thought he was asking because he cared about me, but now I can see that it was all part of his game. It's the same kink as raping those women, then having them followed for so many years. Lydia didn't disagree, but she asked,
Why do you think that?
Because it's about control. He controlled me for years by making me think I had everything I wanted. He controlled you by isolating you away from the family. He controlled Mom by making her think he was the perfect son-in-law. He controlled those women in his files by knowing exactly where they were. Hell, he even controlled Grandma Jenny because she would have been in a state nursing home without his money. For all her noble, impoverished widow bullshit, she loves having a private apartment and weekly maid service. One way or another, we were all under his thumb.
Lydia gripped together her hands on the table.
Why had Claire never seen any of this when Paul was alive? Was he really that good at hiding his darker nature?
Claire said,
God only knows what this Lexi Fuller woman is going through. Maybe he never asked me to do anything weird because he was doing it with her.
She laughed again.
Actually,
part of me hopes that he did, because that would mean that I wasn't completely crazy because he was so goddamn normal. I know you saw through him, but you were the only person in his entire life who thought that something was wrong with him. Even Dad was fooled. I told you I read his journals. The worst thing he ever said about Paul is that he loves me too much. Lydia doubted her father had paid much attention to Paul. Claire was just getting serious about him when Sam Carroll took his life. Lydia had always assumed the tragedy had escalated their relationship. Claire told her, "Paul chose to show you that bad side of himself. He worked his ass off to keep it from everybody else, but he showed it to you because he knew that it would split us apart." "You let him play you!" Lydia didn't realize how angry she was until she said the words. Why did Claire just get to pick up where they left off? She was confiding in Lydia like the last 18 years hadn't happened, like she hadn't been the sole reason Lydia had been shoved out into the cold. She told her sister, "You chose a boy over me." Claire held Lydia's gaze. "You're right. I did. And I don't know that we'll ever get past it, because it's truly unforgivable." Lydia was the first one to look away. She had to remind herself who the real villain was. Paul had dedicated his life to manipulating people. Claire had been a naive and vulnerable teenager when they'd met in college. Helen was still a mess. Sam was on the verge of suicide. Lydia was in and out of jail. Was it any wonder that Paul was able to sink his teeth into her? And yet, Lydia still could not find within herself the ability to forgive. Claire asked, "Do you think I should call Captain Mayhew?"
"For what?"
Lydia couldn't keep the alarm out of her voice. The abrupt change in subject slapped her like a cold wind. "He lied to you about the movies. He said they were fake."
"Maybe he lied because he didn't want me to leak them to the press?"
"No, he would have filed an injunction, or arrested you for interfering with an active investigation, or just told you to keep quiet."
"I'm not going to take this to Agent Nolan," Claire said.
"Who else is left? Huckleberry?" She waved her hand in the general direction of the sheriff's office. "He did a bang-up job with Julia. I'm sure he'd get right on top of this." Lydia felt like they were letting their imaginations get the best of them. "What do we actually know, Claire?"
"That Paul watched the movies. That's it."
"The movies are real."
"We think they're real."
Lydia tried to play devil's advocate again.
"We think that the girl looked like Anna Kilpatrick. We think that she was mutilated in the same way, based on what her mother said and did during a press conference. But are we 100% certain, or are we just talking ourselves into it?"
"Confirmation bias." Claire scowled at her own words. "What's the downside of calling Mayhew?"
"Because he lied to you about the movies? Because he's supposed to be working the biggest case in the city right now, and he stopped everything to go to your house and investigate an attempted burglary. Because he's a cop, and if you piss him off, he can make your life a living hell."
"What is my life now?" Claire held out her hand. "Give me the burner phone." Lydia studied her sister. There was something different about her. She had stopped sounding like a confused bystander and started acting like the person in charge. Lydia asked,
"What are you going to say to him?"
"That he needs to be straight with me. That he needs to explain to me again why the movie isn't real when, according to Eleanor Kilpatrick, her daughter was abused in the same way as the girl in the movie."
"That's a fantastic idea, sweet pea." Lydia layered on the sarcasm. "You believe that a high-ranking police officer might possibly be covering up a murder, or maybe is somehow involved in it, or filming it, or distributing images of it, or maybe all of the above, and you're just going to call him up and say,
Hey, man, what's the what up?
I hadn't planned on sounding like J.J. Walker, but that's the gist.
Claire.
She held out her hand for the phone. Lydia knew her sister's mind was set. She rummaged through her purse for the phone. The back of her hand hit the bottle of Percocet she'd taken from Claire's desk. Lydia had told herself she was keeping the pills from Claire, but she had a niggling suspicion that she was keeping them for herself.
Did you bring it?
Yes, I brought it. Lydia pulled out the phone and handed it to Claire. She snapped her purse closed. Claire easily found Jacob Mayhew's business card in her wallet. She dialed the number and pressed the phone to her ear. Lydia's body tensed. She counted rings that she could not hear. Her palms were sweaty. The sound of rushing blood pulsed into her ears. She hadn't been inside a jailhouse in years, but she was still terrified of the police. Claire shook her head.
Voicemail.
Lydia exhaled a long breath as Claire ended the call.
He'd probably just lie to me anyway.
Claire put the phone down on the table.
Other than you, I don't know who to trust anymore.
Lydia stared down at her hands. Her palms had left wet streaks on the cold, meshed metal. She didn't want to be here. She shouldn't be here. She should go back home to Dee. If they left now, Lydia could be back at the house in time to make her family a late breakfast.
He was at school in March of 91.
Lydia looked back up at her sister.
Paul was living at Lyman Ward Academy when Julia went missing.
Lydia didn't realize the question had been in her mind until Claire had answered it.
Are you sure?
It's just outside of Auburn. He took me to see the campus one day. I didn't know why he wanted to go. He hated every minute he was there, but then we got to the school and I realized he wanted to show me off, which was fine because I like being shown off. But it was a boarding school and it was very small and very religious and incredibly strict. Lydia had made the drive from Auburn to Athens many times before.
Julia went missing at around 11 on a Monday night. It's only 3 hours between here and Auburn.
Paul was 15 years old. He didn't have a license, let alone a car, and they checked on the boys 2 or 3 times a night. Most of them were there because their parents couldn't control them.
Is that why Paul was there?
He told me that he won a scholarship. Claire shrugged. It kind of made sense. His father did a stint in the Navy during Vietnam. Paul was planning on following in his footsteps, at least getting college paid for, until he read a book on architecture and changed his mind.
Lydia didn't buy it.
Paul was really smart. Maybe genius-level smart. If he really wanted to be in the Navy, he would have gone to Knapps or West Point Prep, not some ultra-strict conservative Christian boarding school in the middle of asshole Alabama.
Claire closed her eyes for a moment. She nodded in agreement.
Lydia asked, "Are you sure he didn't sneak out?"
"As sure as I can be," Claire admitted.
"He had perfect attendance the whole time. His picture was still in the trophy case by the headmaster's office, so there was no way he skipped class or got disciplined for being off campus. And spring break was a week later."
"How do you know?"
"Because he went to the Kennedy Space Center to watch the shuttle launch. There was some kind of technical problem, so it didn't go up. I've seen the pictures. He's standing in front of a big banner with a date on it, and you can see the empty launch pad in the distance. And I remember the date was during the second week of March because of Julia."
Lydia looked back at the woman with the broom. She was scraping chairs across the sidewalk as she put together the tables.
Claire said, "That skeevy jackass who got Dad arrested still runs the place." Lydia could vividly recall her mother talking about Sam's arrest in her librarian voice, a furious whisper that could freeze an open flame.
Claire said, "It's weird. I miss Daddy more when I'm with you. I guess because you're the only person I can really talk to who knew him. The door to the Starbucks opened. A group of kids tumbled out onto the sidewalk. Each carried a steaming cup of coffee. They were visibly hungover as they fumbled for their packs of cigarettes. Lydia stood up.
Let's get out of here.
The Tesla was parked in front of the taco stand. Lydia glanced through the restaurant's front windows. The decor had been considerably updated. The chairs were padded. The tables looked clean. There were napkin dispensers on the tables instead of rolls of cheap paper towels. Claire asked,
We're still going to the house, right?
I guess.
Lydia didn't know what else to do but keep moving forward. She got behind the wheel of the Tesla again. She tapped the brake to start the engine. Rick would enjoy hearing details about the car. The touchscreen, the way the steering wheel vibrated if you crossed the yellow line. She would use the information to soften him up, because when Lydia told him what she and Claire had been up to, he was going to justifiably have a fucking fit.
Go back up the Atlanta Highway.
Claire entered the Fuller address into the touchscreen.
I remember dancing to Love Shack with Julia at one of Mom and Dad's Christmas parties. Do you remember? It was 3 months before she went missing.
Lydia nodded, though her mind was still on Rick. Unfortunately, they didn't have one of those relationships where they hid things from each other. They laid it all out, no matter the consequences. He would probably stop speaking to her. He might even see her crazy road trip as the final straw.
This is the way Julia went.
Claire pointed through the arch toward the hill community where Julia had lived during her freshman year. The dorms are air-conditioned now. Mom says they've got free cable and Wi-Fi, a gym, and a coffee bar. Lydia cleared her throat. She had gone from thinking that Rick was going to be mad at her to being mad at Rick for telling her what to do, which was crazy because none of the conversations had actually taken place anywhere but inside her own head. Claire said, "The Manhattan's still over there. It's completely different now."
Does Mom still walk the path on the anniversary?
I think so. We don't talk about it much.
Lydia chewed the tip of her tongue. She wanted to ask if Helen and Claire ever talked about her, but she was too afraid of the answer.
Claire said, I wonder what's wrong with her.
With Mom?
With Lexi Fuller.
Claire twisted in her seat to face Lydia.
Paul obviously chose me because of Julia. I was so vulnerable after she disappeared, he was drawn to my tragedy. Don't you see it?
Lydia hadn't seen it until now.
When we first met, Paul pretended he didn't know about Julia. But of course he knew. His parents lived 15 minutes away from where she disappeared. The farm wasn't self-supporting. His father did seasonal work with the campus grounds crew. His mother did bookkeeping downtown. Missing posters with Julia's face were everywhere. The story was all over the newspaper. Even without that, people in Auburn knew. There were a lot of students from Athens. You were there. You saw it for yourself. We didn't tell a soul, but everybody knew.
Then why did you believe him when he said he didn't know?
Part of me didn't.
I just thought he was trying to be polite, because it was kind of like gossip.
She leaned the side of her head against the seat.
That's the only instance I can think of when I didn't believe him about anything.
Lydia slowed the car as the GPS alerted her to an upcoming turn. Strangely, she got no pleasure from Claire finally seeing the problems that Lydia had spotted 18 years before. Maybe Claire was right. Lydia had only seen the dark side of Paul because he had chosen to show it to her. If that moment in the car had never happened, it was just as likely that she would have tolerated him all these years as an annoying brother-in-law who for some reason made her sister happy. And he had clearly made Claire happy. At least, while he was alive. Knowing how the bastard worked, wooing Claire had probably been part of a long game that started before they even met. Lydia wouldn't put it past him to have a thick file somewhere on Claire Carroll. Was he at Auburn because he knew that Claire would follow Lydia to the university? Was he only working in the math lab because he found out she was flunking trig? Lydia could still remember the breathless way Claire had told her about the new guy she had just met in the lab. Paul had discovered the perfect way into Claire's psyche. He hadn't praised her good looks, which she'd been hearing about practically from infancy. He had praised her mind. And he had done it in such a way that it seemed like he was the only man on the planet who recognized she had more to offer than her face. Lydia pulled the car over to the shoulder. She slid the gear into park. She turned to Claire and told her something that she should have told her all along. "I have a 17-year-old daughter." Claire looked surprised, but apparently not for the reason Lydia was thinking. "Why are you telling me that now?" "You already knew." Lydia wanted to kick herself for being so stupid, and then she wanted to throw up because the idea of Paul paying a stranger to follow her was so deeply unsettling. "Why didn't you tell me Paul had a file on me?" Claire looked away. "I was trying to protect you. I thought if you knew what Paul had done, you would abandon you, like you abandoned me." Claire took a deep breath and slowly let it go. "You're right. Every time I say that you should stay out of this, I find a way to drag you back in because I want my big sister to make it all better." She looked at Lydia. "I'm sorry. I know it sounds trite, but I really am." Lydia didn't want another one of her apologies. "What else do you know about me?"
"Everything," she said. "At least everything that we know about Paul's other victims."
Victim. If she hit that nerve any harder, Lydia was going to need a root canal. She asked Claire, "Did you know about it?"
"Absolutely not. I didn't know about any of them."
"How long was he having me followed?"
"Almost from the moment we stopped talking to each other."
Lydia saw her life flash before her eyes. Not the good things, but the shameful things. All the time she'd walked out of the grocery store with stolen food shoved down the front of her shirt because she couldn't afford to buy anything. The time she'd switched tags on a jacket at the outlet store because she wanted Dee to have the cute one that all the popular girls were wearing. All the lies she'd told about the check being in the mail, the rent money being at work, loans that would soon be repaid. How much had Paul seen? Pictures of Lydia with Rick? Dee on the basketball court? Had he laughed at Lydia struggling her way out of poverty while he sat in his lifeless, air-conditioned mansion? Claire said,
"I know you don't want to hear it, but I am profoundly sorry. I wasn't going to tell you, but then you told me about your daughter, and it felt wrong to pretend."
Lydia shook her head. It wasn't Claire's fault, but she still wanted to blame her.
"She's beautiful," Claire said. "I wish Daddy was still around to meet her."
Lydia felt a current of fear ripple through her body. She had been so focused on what it would feel like to lose her daughter that she had never considered what it would do to Dee if she lost her mother. Lydia realized,
"I really can't do this."
"I know." She didn't think Claire could possibly understand. "It's not just me. I have a family to think about."
"You're right. I honestly mean it this time. You should go."
Claire unbuckled her seatbelt. "Take the car. I can call Mom. She'll get me back to Atlanta." She reached for the door handle. What are you doing?
This is the road Paul lived on. The Fuller house is around here somewhere.
Lydia didn't bother to hide her irritation.
You're just going to walk down the street and hope to find it?
I seem to have a real knack for landing in shit.
Claire pulled on the handle.
Thank you, Liddy. I mean that.
Stop.
Lydia felt certain Claire was hiding something again.
What are you not telling me?
Claire didn't turn around.
I just want to see Lexi Fuller for myself. Lay eyes on her. That's it.
Lydia felt her eyes narrow. Her sister had the carefree air of someone who'd made up their mind to do something stupid.
Why?
Claire shook her head. It doesn't matter, Pepper. Go home to your family.
Lydia grabbed her for real this time. Tell me what you're going to do.
She turned to face Lydia.
I am really proud of you, you know? What you've done with your life, the way you've raised such a smart, talented daughter.
Lydia brushed away the flattery.
You think Lexi Fuller is another one of his victims, don't you?
Claire shrugged.
We're all his victims.
This is different.
Lydia tightened her grip on Claire's arm. She felt a sudden flare of panic.
You think she's locked inside the house or chained to a wall and you're going to go in there all loosey-loo and save her?
Of course not.
Claire looked out at the road.
Maybe she has information that will lead us to the masked man.
Lydia's flesh crawled. She hadn't seen that part of the movie, but Claire's description was terrifying.
Do you really want to meet that guy?
He murdered a woman with a machete, and then he raped her. Jesus, Claire!
Maybe we've already met him.
Claire shrugged, like they were talking unlikely hypotheticals. Or maybe Lexi Fuller knows who he is.
Or maybe the masked man is in that house with his next Anna Kilpatrick. Did you consider that possibility?
Lydia was so frustrated that she wanted to bang her head on the steering wheel.
We're not superheroes, Claire. This is too dangerous. I'm not just thinking about my daughter. I'm thinking about you and me and what could happen to us if we keep digging up Paul's secrets.
Claire sat back in the seat. She stared down the long, straight road ahead of them.
I have to know.
Why? Lydia demanded.
He's dead. You know enough about him now to view that as divine justice. The rest of this we've been doing, it's just asking for trouble.
There's another video out there that shows Anna Kilpatrick being murdered.
Lydia didn't know what to say.
Again, Claire was 10 steps ahead of her.
Claire said, "That's the whole point of the series. To ramp it up to a crescendo, the movies show a progression. The final step is murder, so there must be a last movie that shows Anna being killed."
Lydia knew that she was right. Whoever abducted the girl wouldn't get rid of her without having his fun first.
Okay, let's say by some miracle we find the movie. What would it show us other than someone who might be Anna Kilpatrick being murdered?
Her face, Claire said. The last movie with the other woman showed her face. The camera actually zoomed in on it.
Zoomed in?
Lydia felt like the inside of her mouth had turned into sandpaper.
Not autofocus?
No. It zoomed into a tight frame, so you just saw her from the waist up.
Someone else has to be working the camera to make it zoom.
I know, Claire said, and Lydia could tell from her dark expression that her sister had been skirting around this possibility for a while.
Lexi Fuller?
Lydia tried, because she knew that suggesting Paul as an active participant would be the thing that finally broke Claire in two.
Is that what you're thinking, that
Lexi was behind the camera?
I don't know. But the movies follow the same script, so we can assume that the last Anna Kilpatrick movie zooms in on her face. Lydia chose her words carefully.
You really think if this Lexi person is behind the camera zooming in on a murder, she's going to confess that she's an accomplice and hand over the recording?
I feel like if I see her, look her in the eye, I'll know whether or not she was involved.
Because you're such a fucking great judge of character?
Claire shrugged off the observation. The masked man is out there somewhere. He's probably looking for his next victim. If Lexi Fuller knows who he is, maybe she can help stop him. Lydia said,
Let me get this straight. You get Lexi Fuller to give you a copy of a movie that you think shows Anna Kilpatrick being murdered. Let's set aside the fact that Lexi's incriminating herself. Who would you give the movie to? Mayhew? Nolan?
I could put it on YouTube if someone would show me how.
They'd take it down in 2 seconds, and the FBI would arrest you for disseminating obscene material, and Nolan would testify against you at the trial.
Lydia thought of something far more horrible.
You think the masked man's just going to let all that slide?
Claire kept staring out at the road. Her chest rose and fell with each breath. She had that same look of focused intensity on her face that Lydia had seen back at the coffee house. Claire asked, What if, 24 years ago, two women had information about what happened to Julia? Who took her? Exactly what was done to her? And they kept their mouths shut because they were too afraid to get involved? Lydia tried to give an honest answer.
I hope I would understand that they had to think about their own safety.
Because you're so understanding? Claire shook her head. Likely because she had known Lydia all of her life, and she knew better.
Look at what not knowing did to Dad. Do you want Bob Kilpatrick's suicide on your conscience? Do you want to carry around Eleanor Kilpatrick's misery on your shoulders?
Her tone had become strident.
I have nothing to lose, Liddy. Literally, nothing. I don't have children. I don't really have any friends. My cat is dead. I own a house I don't want to go back to. There's a trust to take care of Grandma Jenny. Mom will survive because she always survives. Paul was my husband. I can't just walk away from this. I have to know. There isn't anything left in my life except finding out the truth.
Don't be so damn dramatic, Claire. You still have me. The words hung between them like weighted balloons. Did Lydia really mean them? Was she here for Claire? Or was this ludicrous road trip really about proving that Lydia had been right about Paul all along?
If that was the case, then her point had been made long ago.
Lydia closed her eyes for a second. She tried to get her thoughts in order.
We'll go by the house. Now who's being dramatic?
Claire sounded as irritated as Lydia felt.
I don't want you to do this. You're not invited.
Tough. She checked the mirrors before pulling back onto the road. We're not going in. Claire didn't put her seatbelt back on. The warning started to chime.
Are you going to jump out of a moving car?
Maybe. Claire pointed up ahead. That must be it. The Fuller house was 30 yards past a shiny silver fire hydrant. Lydia tapped the brake. She coasted the car past the white clapboard house. The roof was new, but the grass in the yard was winter brown.
Weed shot up through cracks in the driveway.
There were weathered sheets of plywood nailed across all the doors and windows.
Even the mailbox had been removed. A lone 4x4 post stuck up like a broken tooth at the mouth of the driveway. Of all the things Lydia expected to find, this was not it. Claire sounded just as puzzled. It's abandoned.
For a long while, it looks like.
The plyboards had started to peel apart. The paint was chipping from the vertical wood siding. The gutters were full. Claire said, "Turn back around." The road was sparsely traveled. They hadn't seen another car since Lydia had pulled over 10 minutes ago. She executed a 3-point turn and drove back toward the house. Claire said, "Pull into the driveway."
"It's private property. We don't want to get shot."
"Paul's dead, so technically it's my property." Lydia wasn't so sure about the legalities, but still she made a wide turn into the driveway. There was something sinister about the Fuller house. The closer they got, the stronger the sensation got. Every bone in Lydia's body was telling her to go back. "This doesn't feel right." "How is it supposed to feel?" Lydia didn't answer. She was looking at the large padlock on the metal garage door. The house was isolated. There wasn't another structure for miles. Large trees forested the areas on either side of the house. The backyard was about 50 feet deep, and beyond that were acres of empty rows waiting for spring planting. Lydia told Claire, "I have a gun." As a convicted felon, she could have gone to jail for possessing a weapon. But Lydia had been a single mother living in some very sketchy neighborhoods when she'd asked a guy at work to get one for her. "I buried it under my back porch steps when we moved into the house. It should still work. I put it in a Ziploc bag."
"We don't have time to go back."
Claire drummed her fingers on her leg as she gave it some thought. "There's a pharmacy off Lumpkin that sells guns. We could buy one and be back here in 30 minutes.
"They'll do a background check."
"Do you think anyone's watching background checks? Mass murderers buy machine guns and enough ammo to take down 20 schools and no one bats an eye."
"Still."
"Crap. I keep forgetting I'm on parole. I'm sure my PO put my name in the system. Where's the NRA when you need them?" Lydia looked at her watch.
"You were supposed to meet Nolan over an hour ago. He's probably put out a bolo on you."
"I have to do this before I lose my nerve." Claire opened the door and got out of the car. Lydia let out a string of curses. Claire went up the stairs to the front porch. She tried to see between the cracks in the plywood covering the windows. She shook her head at Lydia as she walked back down the steps. Instead of returning to the car, she walked around the back of the house. "Damn it." Lydia took her cell phone out of her purse. She should text somebody that they were here. And then what? Rick would panic. She couldn't get Dee involved. She could post it on the Westerly Academy parents' bulletin board, but Penelope Ward would probably hire a private helicopter and fly down to Athens for the story. And then Lydia would have to explain why she was sitting in the car like a coward while her baby sister tried to break into her dead husband's secret house. She got out of the car. She jogged around the side of the house. Weeds as high as Lydia's waist had taken over the backyard. The sturdy-looking swing set was covered in moss. The ground crackled under her feet. The storms had not yet made their way over from Atlanta. The vegetation was as dry as kindling. Claire was standing on the small back porch. She had her foot braced on the side of the house and her fingers curved under the sheet of plywood nailed over the back door. "There's no basement, just a crawl space." Lydia could see that for herself. Claire had kicked in the access panel to the enclosed area under the house. There was less than 2 feet between the dirt and the floor joists.
"What are you doing?"
Ruining my manicure? There's a pry bar in the trunk. Lydia didn't know what to do but go back.